Okay, we'll start. First, I'd really like to thank all the people who brought food. And people have been coming over every night and cooking, actually, at Michael Wick's house. And there are about 15 people, volunteers, working on any given day. And it's been really nice. It's very, very much in keeping with the ancient spirit of Buddhism. You know that the people teaching or helping to arrange the teaching should work for free from their side. And then from the people who are benefiting from it, from their side, that they would offer them something to eat. Okay. So I like it. It's right for both ways. You know, the people doing all the work to help with these classes and all our projects are working for free. And then all the, you know, they can have some nice healthy meal. It's very strange to eat three healthy meals in a row, but but thank you for that. It's been really, really nice. Okay. Tonight we're on the second part of a course called Death and the Realms of Existence. Last class we talked about the existence of three different realms, and I know when I first heard about them, it sounded like some kind of Buddhist mythology that I didn't believe in. And then as I got older and as I understood more, I think it's pretty clear in your mind, you get the feeling that you may really be in a separate corner of the universe called the desire realm, and that you really are here due to your own state of mind, especially as you died in your last life, and that this is what we call a broken realm. It doesn't work, you know. And I think as a Buddhist, it's important to come to a point where you admit it. It's actually renunciation, to come to a point where you say, there's something funny about this realm. There's something inherently defective about this realm. You know, because by now you're 30, 40, 50 years old, and you've been trying, you've been giving it your best effort to try to find the right recipe for life. You know, should I make more money? Should I make less money? Should I eat this food? Should I not eat this food? Should I exercise more? Should I not exercise more? Should I care about things or not care about things? Especially personal relationships, you know, I've tried every different mode and it still doesn't work out. And then I think at a certain age, you get to this kind of a realization that there may be something inherently defective about this particular world that we live in, which the Buddhists call the desire realm. And then you have the motivation to really start a spiritual path. And you can count on Buddhism fixing the problems of this realm, okay? This realm is inherently defective. If you don't take drastic methods outlined in Buddhist path, it will not change. And it does not work the way it is. You will not be happy in this realm. You cannot be. You know, don't, you know, I don't know, in the back of my mind, if I could just have an hour more a day, or if I could just meet different people, or if I could just find an occupation that suits me better, or if I could just get a little more time to exercise, or if I just stopped eating ice cream and ate more salad, you know, that maybe things would straighten out. You know what I mean? No, in the back of your mind, it's there all the time. It's like, if I could just make slight adjustments in my life. The point of the desire realm, get used to it. There's no adjustment you can make to make this place work right. It's broken. It can't work right. You have to find a radical method out of here. You see what I mean? Then people say, escape from the desire realm. You know, how do you do that? You know, is it, because when you say escape, you get this idea of going to Alaska, living in an igloo by yourself, or, you know, taking some drug and going up to a different plane, or you know, you always have this idea of some kind of physical removal of yourself from this realm. It's not like that, okay? It's a spiritual, internal process that by the time you're called the Buddhist path, and by the time you're done with it, the desire realm changes to suit you. and it turns into a Buddha realm. Okay? You won't, don't have to go to a different geographic area. There is no different geographic area. This room is the animal realm, and this room is the human realm at the same time. There are two realms that coexist in the same room. And so, samsara, you know, the realm of suffering, of which the desire realm is the cornerstone, okay? And a Buddha paradise, a tantric paradise, occur in the same physical space, okay? It's a radical transformation of your mind and your behavior that will force you to see this as a different place. And I'm not saying it's a question of attitude. It doesn't matter how positively you think about the desire realm, it still won't work. Okay? It's not a question of like trying to see it in a night, find the silver lining in the desire realm. It's not like that, okay? I'm not suggesting that you consciously try to cheer up and try to see things as not being so bad or something like that. They are bad. They're deadly. And up to the time you die, they're miserable. So miserable plus deadly is the desire realm. No. And you can't try to see it as a nice place or something. We're not saying that. We're saying change your karma radically. Change your vow keeping radically. And force a change in your perceptions of this realm. And it will just go away. And that's freedom from the desire realm. Okay? And you gotta get used to that. Okay? It doesn't help to go live in Arizona in some mountain where nobody will bother you. Because the main person who bothers you is going with you. Okay? Alright? No, really, people have great hopes for Arizona, and I'm like, calm down, you know. You take your baggage with you wherever you go, okay? And it won't be any happier there within 6 weeks, okay? You have more conditions for meditating and practicing, but your basic level of happiness is independent of your location, okay? You carry your happiness, whatever level it is, wherever you go. And it doesn't change because you change your address, okay? You have to follow Buddhism. Okay. I'm going to let the class teachers go over the first question on the homework. It concerns in the Abhidharma, there's a very beautiful presentation about four different kinds of sustenance in this realm. In other words, you can live off of solid food, but you can also live off of other things. And this is in the most basic school of Buddhism, and then by the time you get to Tantra, these things take on new significance. You know, what is it that makes your body run? Is it really food? And what is it about food that makes your body run? And could you do without food? You know, I always say no because I enjoy eating it so much, you know. But are there other ways to exist beyond food? We'll cover that, okay? And that the roots for that teaching, like all the roots of the highest tantric systems, are sitting there in the lowest schools of Buddhism. And you have to realize that Lord Buddha is this mastermind who's setting you up for something 10 years from now, 15 years from now, okay? With Abhidharma, lowest school, okay? Then there's a section on the eight different kinds of hot hells. These are the major hells. There are eight hot hells, eight cold hells. There are what we call secondary hells. There are what we call near hells, which are in this on our earth. We'll be covering that in your breakout sessions. All I would say about the hell realms is that we did it in the Tonglen up at Godso recently. We did a meditation on the hell realms. And I think it's try to imagine a place. I said start out with Kansas. If you've ever driven through Kansas, it's like totally flat. And all you can see in every direction is the same sky and the same cornfields. So imagine a place like that. The cornfields are not there. The ground turns into steel without a rivet. You see, just pure, smooth, flat steel stretching to the horizon. And then this people milling around on it like in a Fifth Avenue, like thousands of people pushing, shoving, moving in like flows and eddies. You know what I mean? Like how sometimes a whole group of people will move one way and then move another way. And then naked. People have no clothes on. And then just the ground started to heat up to a red heat, like burning steel, like hot steel. And then the idea of millions of naked people that look like you or me just running and screaming and pushing at each other and trying to run to the horizon, but there's nothing there except another horizon. See what I mean? Like no possible place to go. But they're compelled to run because they hurt so bad. So then they're just running. And then they're screaming and they're shoving into each other and violently pushing each other, trying to go somewhere, but there's no place to go. And living like that for years and being unable to die. Okay, it's one of the part of the hell realms is that you can't die. You know, things that would normally kill you, you can't even get killed. You know, if things got really hot and your feet started to fall apart or something, you wouldn't be able to die anyway. You'd be running on your ankles and on your wrists or something. And you can't die. And that's a nature of a hell realm. So I can describe it. You get a feeling for it. They do exist. These places do exist. There are beings there like that. And all it takes is a slight change in your perceptions to be there. Okay? And very, very terrible place. So those, and you have an instinct for that. You've been there thousands and thousands of times. People say, young people especially, they say, death is romantic, you know. What's that guy, Kurt Cobain, you know. It's so romantic to have a nice, beautiful girlfriend and play for a Nirvana rock band and then end your life by taking some heroin or something. And it's a very attractive thing to the Gen X. And they say that. They say, oh, the great adventure of death. I look forward to it. But they have no idea it's really, really bad. You know what I mean? It's hopeless after that. To be in this realm is like a very brief vacation, and then most of the beings in the world are in those realms. And it's no big romantic mystery or anything like that. It's just basic terror and suffering. And deep down inside, every human being knows it. And that's why you take someone up to a tall building and you get them towards the edge and you hold them by the shoulder and you go like that, and they fight you. You know, there's this internal reflex. It's not a reflex, it's a knowledge subconsciously of what it's going to be like 10 minutes later, because you've been through it thousands and thousands and thousands of times. You may not remember it, but you have an instinct for it. That's why people fight to live. When it really comes down to it, only crazy people kill themselves in a fit of craziness, and then everyone else is like, will do anything not to die. You know what I mean? And that's because you know what you were in before. You have an instinct for it, and that's why you fight death. You will fight it at anyone's expense. You don't want to die. You see what I mean? And that's the nature of the desire realm. Okay, really don't want to go there. I mean, I don't like to talk much about hell realms because I think positive reinforcement is better. I'd rather describe a tantric paradise and inspire you to try to get there. The paradise is, they say the goal is total bliss and the path is total bliss. And get used to that, okay? I mean, the Judeo-Christian thing is you have to suffer to get to paradise. The Buddhist thing is you're getting to total ecstasy, and towards the end, the exercise is total ecstasy. To get there involves very beautiful, happy, pleasant life and way of living. And the whole way to live as you get closer and closer is more and more pleasant. Your body starts to change. You get younger. Your mind starts to become this beautiful, happy place to live in. And you're happy almost all the time. And almost everything makes you happy. And almost everything can send you off into this mood of deep bliss. So even the path to get there is pleasant, and the place you're going to is even better as you accelerate towards the goal. So I'd rather sell you that then say that, by the way, if you turn around, there's this hell realm, you know. But really, you have to have both motivations, okay? There is a hell realm. You can get there easily by making small mistakes in your practice. And you have to be really careful, and you have to understand that, okay? Yeah.
Question comes out. Yeah. My ignorance, I'm in the desire realm. Very ignorant to this study. But I wonder about what Buddha has said about the experience of the near-death experience. I had a near-death experience which was blissful. Mm-hmm. I was dead for a moment. And what does it mean? If it's all horror, why would I have such moody?
At the beginning of the death process, you have certain hallucinations, standard hallucinations, like five standard hallucinations. And the beginning of those hallucinations is some kind of extraordinary feeling of power, what we call bardo being, a being in the state between death and rebirth. The beginning of that process is quite pleasant. You can fly, you feel your body is very light, you're released from all the pain you used to have. You can understand people's thoughts, you can understand foreign languages, you can pass through solid objects, like that. You have this clairvoyance for a while, and that ends about 5 minutes later. And then the real hallucinations start. So, until you really die, you don't get to those. Near-death experiences can involve the start of that process, which can be pleasant. Then about 5 to 10 minutes later, as you're really dead, the serious hallucinations begin, which are very terrifying, and then things get worse. Okay, so yeah, the beginning could feel like that, but once death has occurred, very terrible thing. Yeah?
This desire realm that we live in, this inherently defective realm we live in, we as residents, are we perfect, whole, and complete?
No, not perfect. We have a seed for perfection. And I don't know. No, what we say is look at your body aging. Look at all the thoughts in your mind. Especially, you know, we say you have 6 standard terrible ways of thinking, 20 others. I mean, jealousy, anger, irritation at other people. I mean, there may be perfect beings among us. Any percentage of the people around you may be perfect beings masquerading as normal people, okay? But if you are a normal person, the condition of your body and mind is something terrible. Its nature is to get older, more and more sick each year, more and more weak, less and less energy. And the nature of the mind is to constantly have anger, desire, jealousy, at some level all day long, based on your own selfishness. And in a kind of selfishness that is turned on 24 hours a day, of wanting to take care, naturally spending most of your time and attention taking care of your own needs and ignoring other people's needs. People are proud if they spend an hour a day at a hospital. That's still 23 to 1. You see what I mean? And we don't live well either. We have a seed.
Yeah.
Oh, we say you have to start with that, but the bias is so obvious. You know? I mean, no, you have to take care of yourself. But the relative time you spend on one person as opposed to a few dozens is obvious. You know? That disparity is obvious. And it's a reflection of our natural mental state, which is defective. And but the purpose to be a Buddhist and the purpose to follow this path is to reach the perfection, which you do have the seed of that perfection in you. Every human being has what we call Buddha nature, meaning a capacity of becoming a perfect being, perfectly loving, compassionate, and physically perfect being. But this is to say, this is physical perfection. I mean, I wouldn't have a bald spot, and I wouldn't have wrinkly hands, and I wouldn't be getting weaker. You know what I mean? It's not. It's really not. We can do. There is a body of light that you can get to, and it works better. And you know, it's not a nice realm to be in. It's not nice. Oh, It comes as quickly as you practice the path.
So it could happen here.
We say if you practice Tantra properly in this lifetime, then before you die, everything, you would reach everything. Total perfection, physical and mental perfection. Yeah. In a perfect world. Okay. This realm would then be transformed into a Buddha paradise for you only. Yeah, okay. No, now people around you might think you're still a schmuck or something. You know? Okay? No, I mean, they might look at you and say, he's just as bad as he was 10 years ago. And you can be looking in the mirror and seeing a tantric deity. You see what I mean? Because you've kept your vows perfect, and then your realm will change. But they may still see you as a normal person. In fact, they would have to, actually, unless they had also followed the path in a very good way. Okay? So that's important to say. Okay? All right. We're going to talk a little bit about the death meditation. I think it's important to talk about it. It was very popular in recent years to talk about death meditation, and there were a lot of things come out about the experience of going through death. And I think it became sort of a thing where you thought death meditation was sitting down, closing your eyes, and seeing purple lights go by, and then red lights go by, and then yellow lights getting fainter and fainter, and then white light, and then some kind of clear light. And then you do poa, they say, or jud, and they snap their fingers, and suddenly they're in a Buddha realm. You know, if you can just do it at the right moment of your death process. And this is a very popular teaching. It's been spoken a lot in the United States, more and more. And you have to understand this. When we talk about transforming this realm into a different realm, that has to be done while your mind is lucid. It's a result of years and years of devoted effort and work on your own mind and your own heart and meditation. And then you can best do it, frankly, in your 20s and 30s or something like that. I mean, while you have energy, while your mind is sharp, while you're physically able to sit for long periods of meditation, if you work very hard, and if you follow to the letter the instructions of authoritative scriptures and lamas, then you have a chance of pulling off a tantric paradise in this lifetime. If not, then you must enter the death process. You must go through the death process. And it's always chaotic. As your mind starts to break down, as the electrical currents start to go wild, there's a standard set of hallucinations that you have. They are not pleasant. They are very, very frightening, universally frightening. And then you actually have a special kind of pain that you undergo as you die. And this pain is like nothing you've ever felt before. And it's the pain of the moment of death. And it's just all the scriptures talk about it, and this is what the normal death process is, okay? Your mind at that point is actually started to break down, okay? It's not working as well as it was before. You're unable to think clearly. You're overcome by waves of fear, emotion. If you think about how upset you'd be if someone came up and cut your finger off, then imagine how upset you'd be if someone came up and cut all your fingers off. And it's the combined upsetness of having every piece of your body cut off and losing it. And on top of that, all the years of care you've taken about your body. You see what I mean? The years of combing the same person's hair. The years of brushing the same person's teeth. The years of looking for clothes to fit this particular body, you know, the years of finding a house for this body to live in, and a job for this body to have, and a car for this body to drive in, and then all those accumulated desires for this particular body are all being expressed in the moments of death. You are being cheated out of 70 years of intense effort. to take care of this body, and you're very upset. Okay? I mean, the accumulated effect of worrying about this body minute by minute for 70 years, can you imagine the amount of feeling you, the internal feeling you have for this body is unthinkable, you know? And then to think you're going to lose it at that moment. We say your mind goes into a special, horrible place of like rage that this body is being destroyed. The one that you combed for 50 years, whatever was left, you know? And okay, and then there's this rage that this thing's being taken away from you. And the point is, you don't want to wait till the last minute to do something about it. They say there are teachings that if you do special practices as you die, you maybe have a good chance to change realms at that moment or something like that. In theory, this is possible. In practice, it's impossible. Okay? You are totally upset. You're totally frightened. It's the worst nightmare you've ever had. It's the worst hour of your life that's ever happened. And to imagine that you could go into a deep state of meditation, see emptiness that you didn't see in 50 years of lucid thought on the comfort of your meditation cushion, you know? It's ridiculous. It's flatly ridiculous. The point of a death meditation has nothing to do with those things, okay? Death meditation is take care of things now, okay? If you're doing a good death meditation, you are getting your mind into a state where you believe you're going to die tonight. And every moment of your day, you act as if you are going to die tonight, okay? That's a Buddhist death meditation. Forget the purple lights. Forget, if it was easy to get to a Buddhist paradise by thinking something as you die, Lord Buddha would have taught that. We'd go around giving Kool-Aid injections to everybody after giving them the instructions. And that'd be it, because Buddhists love us. They want us to get to paradise. If it was that easy, that's all they would do. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. It's obvious it doesn't work that way, or else the Dalai Lama himself would be going around doing Dr. Kevorkian or whatever for people after giving them the poem instructions. You know what I mean? It doesn't work like that at all. You must do death meditation. What is the goal of death meditation? It's not to be able to die with some kind of special lights in your head or something like that. It's that starting tonight, starting now, as you sit on that chair, you begin to get into a special frame of mind. What is that frame of mind? I'm dying tonight. Now what do I do? You see what I mean? And every hour of your conscious life, you are examining your activities. You're examining your work. You're examining your state of mind, and you're saying, do I really want to die like this? You see what I mean? You just evaluate your whole life, hour by hour. Am I ready to die tonight? Is this what I want to do for my final 4 hours? You know, is this what I would be doing if I only had 4 hours left? And if you start thinking like that all the time, you've mastered Buddhist death meditation. Okay? Then you're ready to study Poa. Okay? Then you're ready to study how to do special death practices. But in the meantime, much more powerful. And I can't describe to you how good it feels to be a good death meditator. It's amazing. You know, people ask His Holiness, sounds pretty depressing, you know. He says, hey, no way. It's liberating, okay? Imagine how it would be to live every day as if you're going to die tonight. Cut all the crap of your life 100% now. You see what I mean? Throw out every possession you have that doesn't immediately serve your physical needs. Just clean out your house. Get rid of it. Move into a small room. You know what I mean? No more rent to pay. No more worries. Have one or two sets of clothes in case you want to change before you die tonight. Okay? Die in a fresh dress. Okay? Like that. What else do you need? You see what I mean? And it's liberating. You can finally do all the things you wanted to do. Okay? I say start with the worldly things. Go parachuting. Try sky hang gliding. You know, do that scuba trip. You know, tell your boss to go to hell. Walk out. You know, you don't need any money. You're standing, the elementary stages of death meditation are quite interesting. Yeah, I always wanted to write poetry instead of working in that company. So you just leave at lunchtime and you don't come back. And you go to the park and write some poems, you know? And it's liberating. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't have a career or you shouldn't have a job or you should walk out on your wife or your kids or your house payments or anything like that. I'm just saying if you do a good death meditation, gradually, inexorably, your life will become an incredible, happy, extraordinary, creative thing because your mind is totally freed. What would happen if you kept this way of thinking up regularly for 6 months? Can you imagine what your life would be like? You know, no more magazines laying around your apartment, no more junk possessions. 90% of your possessions are junk possessions. You don't use them, you don't look at them, you clean them, you pay for them, you take care of them, you find a place for them to be, and you don't even use them, and you don't need them. Just get rid of, you see, if you're in this state of mind, I'm going to die tonight, think of how many things you'd quit. You know what I mean? All the junk, you just quit. Go into some really beautiful 2-hour meditation. Because that's all that really matters at that point, or something like that. But start with all the stuff you always wanted to do. What I'm saying is that if you've become a good death meditator, you might want to go try to learn to dance or play guitar or, you know, do all the things you wanted to do. Give up the things you don't really love. You're going to die anyway. So why not die doing the things you want to do? Then as you get more sophisticated, you'll find that those don't make you happy either. Really. And you will quickly get to the Buddhist path. You see what I mean? Then all that illusion that there's a few more things you wanted to try will be taken care of. You see what I mean? All the stuff you thought you might want to try, do it. You know? Do it. Change your job to what you thought you really wanted. After 6 months, you'll find out it's not, and then you'll be able to meditate better. Okay? But what I'm saying is, it's a very liberating thing. Real death meditation. And we're going to go over all the steps and the 9 reasons and the blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is this. Act at every moment as if you were going to die tonight. Okay? And your Buddhist practice should be just the same way. Streamlined. No crap. No practices which are nice and which don't get you liberated by tonight. Okay? I mean, clean up that too. Most people's practice is very similar to their apartments. Okay? I mean, I'm talking about people who are even practicing. Okay? Which is only a few. But even those people, your practice is junked up with, oh, I kind of wanted to do this. I'm halfway through reading this. I kind of studied that. I got a little bit of this memorized. And I have 4 meditations that I do, but I don't really do any of them. You know what I mean? And if you knew you were going to meditate and die tonight, then just cut the crap in your practice also. Get it down to the 1 or 2 heavy, intense karmas that will help you when you die, which frankly is Guru Yoga and Tantra or something like that, which are really the same thing. So, you know, clean it down to that. Don't try to do 63 different things and you're not doing any of them. You are going to die tonight. Now, what do you want to happen as you die? What's your goal? You know, I have people come to me, I have 13 sadhanas I committed to. Which one should I do? Which 12 should I do? Or something like that, you know. You're going to die tonight. I suggest you take a few lines out of your favorite sadhana and meditate on them. Something to do with your root lama or something. And then forget the rest. You know what I mean? You don't have time. You're going to die tonight. So, I mean, live every moment as if you're going to die tonight. Don't wait and say, oh, I can't get to that practice, or I'm not good enough, or I don't understand that, or I'm afraid of that, or something like that. Forget all that. You're going to die tonight. Be more thoughtful of that poor slob who's going to be dying, which is you. You know what I mean? You now are not being fair to him. or her a year from now or 2 years from now or a week from now who's sitting on the deathbed dying and it's too late to do anything because you wasted your time. He will curse you. You know what I mean? And you also have to be considerate, you know? He is your future self. She is your self a year from now. You should be only doing those things which are directly, immediately, powerfully getting you as close as you can to a Buddha paradise in this lifetime. Or you're not really being fair to them. You see what I mean? So you have to examine, even those people who are practicing have to examine their motivation for doing the practices they do. How serious are you? Or is it just that you like the practice? You see what I mean? Did you really want to get to a Buddha paradise? Or were you more attracted to a new set of clothes or a new language or you know, this philosophy that you can impress people with on Thursday nights? Okay? You know what I mean? Cut the crap. Get down to the practices that are important to help you if you're going to die tonight. That's all. And by the way, you will never regret it. And every day you spend like that is one more incredibly happy day. If you get your life streamlined by a good death meditation, your mind is clear, your heart is clear, you're happy, you're relaxed. And Jetsun Kapa says, then you can really die right. You know, the only people who go into death right are the people who year after year, day after day, hour after hour have been living as if they were going to die tonight. Because then when it happens, they're like, I knew that was going to happen. You know, I took care of that 2 years ago. You know, I went straight to the teachings that were important and I practiced them and I mastered them. I'm not afraid to die. It's only these people that die well. They die happy. They took care of everything. They've already achieved what they had to achieve. Okay, time to go. Relaxed. To be relaxed, happy, contented, in the knowledge that you have practiced perfectly. Only those things which were most important, as if you were going to die tonight for the last few years, then you can die well. That's a real death meditation. Okay? And you have to try to reach that state of death meditation. It's not colored lights, okay? It's not like, oh, booga booga when you die, you know. It's not like that. Okay? If you practice this way, then as you die, you have a real chance. You know what I mean? You have a real chance to do some extraordinary things. Okay? But actually, I don't think you will die. Okay? That's the whole point. I think when you teach death meditation to your students in the future or this evening, it's important to say, look, if you lived each day as if you were going to die tonight, you wouldn't die anyway. You would enter a tantric paradise in this lifetime. And it would be a moot point should you look at the red colored light or the purple colored light. Okay? There won't be any colored lights. Because you don't die. Okay? And I can't describe you, even if all this Buddhist stuff is BS, and even if all this stuff is not true, if you lived your life as if you're going to die tonight, you can't imagine how pleasant that is after a number of months and years. You know what I mean? To keep living like that every single day for years is extraordinarily pleasant and exciting and creative. Okay? You're just totally liberated from all the heavy weight of all the junk that we carry around. Okay? Physically and mentally and emotionally. Totally, you feel like you weigh 10 pounds. You know, you feel like you're walking on air all the time. It's beautiful. It's really cool. Actually, you're transforming the desire realm. Okay, when you do a good death meditation, you finally decide to work on the most important things to help you by tonight. You know, and you go quickly through the perfections, quickly into Tantra. And you work hard on it. And then everything is taken care of itself. And yeah, this realm will be transformed for you. Okay? And everybody else may think you're crazy. Okay? And you gotta get used to that. Okay? They may not, if they are not doing those things, you will look crazy to them. You gotta, they say, ni tene pi, ki tene lip, means you'll be expelled from the ranks of men and reach the ranks of dogs. Meaning, everybody will think you're crazy. Okay? And I don't mean you have to sit on the corner and spout mantras and act crazy. I'm not saying that. Just if you gradually divest of unnecessary activities and possessions, you will look unusual to other people. If you truly try to practice the most important practices and not even deal with less important practices, you will also look strange to more people, okay? And you have to keep your motivation in mind. Why am I doing this? Because I'm going to die tonight. I don't have time for that, you know? I respect that. I think it's a good thing. Lord Buddha taught A, Lord Buddha taught B. B works faster. Now, you guys may have longer to live than me, but I'm dying tonight. I have to work on this thing, okay? And necessarily, you will look a little strange to other people in the desire realm. Okay? And don't forget, and I say it boldly and without embarrassment, that anyone who's here in this realm and who is not an emanation of an enlightened being is messed up. Okay? Physically and mentally. Okay? You're here. Your presence here proves that you're messed up. Okay? In the desire realm. If you've made it to the desire realm, your mind is messed up and your body is messed up. And it's going to break. You know, the body's going to break down. The mind is still clinging to wrong ideas, wrong possessions, wrong ways of living. And you, if you start to fix yourself in the desire realm, you will look strange to the other denizens of the desire realm. By definition. Okay, does that mean you should disrespect people and act weird or so? I'm not saying that. You have to be more respectful, more thoughtful and like that. But at some point, there'll be a disparity between the way you act and the way other people in the desire realm act, because all of their actions are crazy. Okay? To work for 50 years, to have 50 weeks, to have 2 weeks of your own time, is that crazy or what? It's crazy. It's just crazy. What? So you can have a wash machine instead of having two sets of clothes that you wash by hand and it only takes you an hour? You know, it's crazy. It's just crazy. It's really crazy. The whole exercise is crazy. You know, to hate other people when they get something good. You know, it's weird. People here are weird. Okay. And you will start to look weird if you try to change yourself. Anyway, I'm saying death meditation is that. It's so sweet. Great death meditation. Okay. Two other things I would say. It's important to know how to die right. It's important to know what happens as you die. And you should learn that. I think what I'll try to do is hand out a document that Ken Rinpoche wrote. It was mostly the result of an interview we did with him. The only time he ever submitted to questions was when he was in a car or a plane and couldn't get away. And we did it on a plane to India from Germany and asked him everything I ever wanted to ask him about dying. And he gave beautiful answers, and we wrote them out, and I'll try to hand that out next time. Okay? It's instructions on what you should do as you die, and what you should do for other people that you love who are near you as they die. You know, what you can do for them. And it clears up a lot of misconceptions about the death process. Okay? The only other thing I wanted to say about death, and then I think you guys can cover the rest in your breakout classes. There is a real power, okay? There is a real death meditation for dying, okay? By the way, the death meditation I covered so far is death meditation for what? Living. And you live like a king, okay? If you really do death meditation, every hour of the day, you know, F you to all the other junk of the world. I'm concentrating on the most important things happily, and I'm not weighed down by all the other possessions and activities and concerns. Your mind is like, feels like cotton candy or something. Tastes like that, okay? And happy all the time. That's for living, okay? And that's for dying right. But as you enter the death process, there is a meditation you should do, okay? That's found in the Lojong text. We covered it in the Lojong class. I didn't make it part of this reading tonight, but I'll describe it to you, okay? And you can practice it every time you get sick, or every time you're having some emotional pain, or any kind of problem in a relationship or anything else, okay? Somebody you love leaves you, you know? You find out you have breast cancer. You go home and you just feel depressed all day, okay? You didn't get enough sleep, or you can't sleep. This is good for, it's not amnesia, what do they call it? Insomnia, okay? Alright? I'm saying for all those moments, insomnia, depression, you just found out you have cancer or HIV or whatever, or you have some kind of emotional pain, you just lost someone close to you, or someone died, or someone walked out on you, or something like that. Okay, in all of those situations, you can use this meditation, which I want you to use when you die, but there are so many other lousy occasions during life, you can use it then too, and get practice, you see. And this is the ultimate poa. It's presented in text of Chikawa, Geshe Chikawa, and this is a beautiful lojong. So it's basically this, and he did it on his deathbed. There's a record of his students standing around like with Socrates and recording what he said as he died, okay? And it's like this. When you die, you'll get to some kind of incredible pain will start to in your body. And that's the pain of dying. And this is a special physical pain that all people have as they die. Bugs have it. Cows have it. People have it. Fish have it. You can see them as they die. Something's going on. As you watch from the outside. So, you meditate very, very hard that all the pain of all the people that you can imagine and all the living creatures you can imagine is sucked into the pain that you're having. Okay? So it's a very specific exercise of imagining that you are going to eliminate the pain of the entire world by dying with it. Okay? It's like that movie, The Exorcist, okay? the priest takes the evil demon inside of him and jumps out the window. Okay? It's the same idea. You, as you're dying, when you start to feel that pain, you say, okay, I'm in for a bad time. And I know it. I remember that class back in 99. Okay? At least let me do something useful with this pain. But you can use this for every pain you ever have. Emotional, physical, relationships, whatever, okay? Use it all the time when some poop hits the fan, which is usually like once a week, right? Okay? Okay? But focus on the pain that you're having, which is not unreal. It's real, okay? Have someone walk out on you in a relationship, to find out you have cancer, to lose your job, something like that. That's pain. Take the pain, make it a physical thing in your mind, like almost like a ball, okay, in your chest, and then pray that all the pain that other people are feeling around you should be sucked into that pain as you experience it, okay, as you're going to experience it. So at least other people shouldn't have the pain that I'm going to go through, okay? By my feeling this pain, may other people's pain be taken away from them and die with me. Okay, and then everybody else in the world is free from whatever pains they have. Okay, very, very holy way to die. Okay, very, very holy way to die. I don't have anything more to say about it than that. Okay, just do it. Okay, best way to die. If by chance you find yourself hit by a car tonight, as you're on the sidewalk, you know, people standing around goggling at you, then remember, you know, we say it's good to practice. Okay, in Buddhism, you can practice it two times. One, anytime you have any kind of disappointment or trouble during the day, just say, okay, I have to go through this kind of pain. Apparently I'm stuck with this kind of pain. So I pray that other people's pain be experienced by me and that they don't have it anymore. Okay? And just decide. You know, I'm having a bad day. My boss is crazy today. Well, at least may I take all the other bad boss pain that other people are having in Manhattan today, and I will stand for all their pain. Okay? So just decide every time. This is practice for when you die. Very, very good practice. Okay? If you don't practice it, you probably won't be able to do it when you die. Okay? Secondly, as you fall asleep, okay, imagine that you're going into a death consciousness. Okay? Imagine, as your mind goes into sleep, imagine that your mind is going into the unconscious state of death. Okay? And as you go, practice this death meditation. Say, okay, anybody in the world who's dying tonight, as I fall asleep, may I take your pain away from you. Okay? As I enter death, okay, I take it away from you. All right? Very important to do that. We say then at the final moments of consciousness, in both cases, you imagine that pain is some kind of black thing in your heart, and then you blow it off with this burst of light, like burst of golden light. And you can, that's very important, okay? You're not supposed to go to sleep with all this pain in your heart. You'll have heartburn in the morning, okay? Just before you fall off to sleep, very important, boom. You know, big flash, like a photo flash, and it, all that pain is gone. Like your pain, their pain is gone. And then fall asleep, okay, like that. Very beautiful meditation. The difference between waking consciousness and sleeping consciousness is very similar to the difference between living consciousness and in process of death consciousness. And so if you practice it night after night, when the time comes, it'll be a reaction. It'll be a natural reaction to try to take other people's pain away into your pain as you die. Okay. Now, last thing, I'll tell you a story about someone who did it, and then we'll take a break. Geshe Chikawa is on his deathbed, 1100, something like that. AD, Tibetan Lama, Great Lama. He's been teaching this stuff his whole life, and he's dying. And his students are standing around, you know, what's happening, you know? And he's dying, and he said, okay, I'm doing it, you know? I'm feeling the pain. He says, yeah, and I'm trying to take all the pain of all the living beings. And there's this silence, you know? And he's like, now I'm trying to take the pain of all the hell realms. And there's this silence, you know? And then they say, now I'm trying to go to the hell realms. I'm trying to send my mind down the hell realms so I can take care of them in my next life, you know? And he's like, and then there's this long silence. He's like, oh man, it's not working, you know? And they're like, are you all right? You know, and he says, oh, it's terrible, you know? And they're like, what's going on, you know? And he says, I can't do it. It's not working, you know? And they're like, what, you can't get to hell? He says, man, it's not working. Every time I have that thought to go to hell, all I see is these Buddha paradises. And he's like, I'm upset, you know? He's like, angry, you know? He's like, I can't believe it. I practiced my whole life, and now these paradises and deities and angels coming for me, and I can't, so disappointed. And he died like that. He died saying that, okay? That's actually what will happen, okay? That's actually the process that you've gone through, okay? The intention of doing that is almost like an instant karma, okay? And I think, frankly, and I'm not afraid to talk about it, I think the final act of Christ is very similar. And I don't have any embarrassment to say, I totally believe it's a beautiful death practice. I believe that, you know, the Christians say, take away the sins of the world or something like that. We don't believe that you can take on someone else's karma. But the intention to do so and to die that way is the ultimate way to die. You know, if you really want to get your mind into a Buddha paradise as you die, and if you want to set up your mind to be able to take away the sins of the world by becoming an enlightened being in the future, this is absolutely a perfect way to die. This is a perfect act, you know, of Tonglen on the cross. And that's, you know, you can't read the Tibetan descriptions of how to do it without thinking of that thing. They almost read the same word for word, you know. And so it has to be a very holy practice that people have done throughout the world, okay? All right, can I take a break? Okay, we'll start. It's about a 5-minute thing. He always says that, right? First thing, last Friday morning we took one day Mahayana precepts, and a lot of people came up to me and said, that was really fun. And could we do it more often? Okay. And I also had a really good time. So I think we will do it more often. Like, there are 5 or 6 major Buddhist holidays throughout the year. There are other very holy days like Ken Rinpoche's birthday or the Dalai Lama's birthday, things like that. So I think we can come up with excuses to do them more often. And And then I wanted to mention, and I forgot to mention during the ceremony last Friday, that you are therefore empowered to do them yourself, okay? So once you've taken them from somebody else, you are empowered to take them by yourself, and you just do it in front of a Buddha image in your own home with the same rules. Now, we went over the vows in great detail during the ceremony last Friday, and Winston taped it. I don't know where he went to. He's agreed to hand a copy of the tape over to the Moors, who are here. Don't not raise your hand. Okay. And they're in charge of production of all tapes. Like, they'll keep a production master, and then when you need a copy, you can ask them. What I suggest is you just get up at 4:30 and turn on the tape. And seriously, and just follow it and do the whole thing. And after you've done that once or twice, you'll be able to take them yourself. Hopefully, before going into tree retreat, I could maybe translate the text into English. But even without that, you can still recite it in Tibetan. It's a holy language. There's a lot of Sanskrit in there, which is also a holy language. And so you can actually take them anytime you like. Okay? So get a hold of that. Yeah? Gududu and Sojong dates, 15th and the 8th, and the 1st and of the Buddhist month, okay? Just wanted to mention two things about two side projects that are happening in Arizona, and I think they apply to what Buddhists can do to help other people, and I think should be maybe a part of American Buddhism as it goes into the future. So these wrap-up talks have been about American Buddhism. I think the first project that we'll be doing there, you know, when we negotiated the contract for the land, which will be signed shortly, and we do, it looks like we have enough money to buy the first parcel by about $1 or something. It looks okay. Not sure yet, but it looks okay. We will be buying a huge U-shaped piece of property of about, I don't know, 4,000 acres or something like that. And then inside of the U is a big block of property that's 5,000 acres. And if you buy the 4, you get the 5. And the 5 belong to the state of Arizona, and they are called state lease land. And whoever owns the property around it gets to rent the land in the middle for $1.10 an acre a year. And you are required to run cattle on it. And 65% of the property of that county is state lease land like that. So we were struggling with what to do with this problem. You know, like, we would like to have the property because it'll make the place quieter. There'll be a big buffer of about a mile around the meditation cabins and stuff. But what are we going to do with these cows? You know, there's like 250 cows on the property, and we have to take care of them. And first we went to the state, we said, do we have to kill them? Can we just let them live, you know, and take care of them? And we're negotiating all of this with the state. And then we went to some, like, sponsors, like Jains, wealthy Jains that I know in the Indian Diamond community, and asked them, would they like to help us keep these cows alive, which is a big thing for them. And then I was thinking of it just as a way to raise funds or something like that. And then we've been having meetings with these Jain diamond dealers, and they've been expressing their passion for this idea that, hey, you're Americans, you know, if you get into creating these, they have these special ranches all over India supported by the Jain and the Hindu communities where they just keep animals till they die, and it could be a cow or it could be any other kind of animal. And they were so passionate about the idea. Like, yesterday we had a meeting with the head of the Jain Association of the United States, and this is a very powerful diamond dealer, and he's so excited about the idea. He says, you don't even know what you're starting. You know, you think you're just raising some funds. Think about it, you know. If American people get up and start talking about this idea, and the whole world looks to America, like, all, even in India, we don't like America, but we're looking to America, to see what we're supposed to do next, you know. And if in America, normal American people decide that it's important not to kill these animals, it could start a whole different way of looking at animals, and a whole different way of treating animals, and a whole different way about thinking about the question of killing animals for our meat. Which I'm not going to talk about that tonight. There's a big debate about it in Buddhism. Traditionally, we have eaten meat, I think, based on the fact that when you go out with your begging bowl as a monk, you're not allowed to say, "I don't like eggplant. You know, could I just have a little more of the ice cream?" You know, and you know, you're supposed to take whatever they put in your bowl and eat it. You know, and that's a tradition. So I think on that basis, we've been eating meat. People ask me, is eating meat a bad deed? It's not listed in the scriptures as a bad deed. The Lotus Sutra does say some heavy things about not eating meat. And when you take one day Mahayana vows, you're not allowed to eat meat. Now that's an indication that we think there's something wrong with it. Technically, you're not killing when you buy meat. Technically, you're buying meat. Untechnically, you've contributed to a process of killing. And I think, almost assuredly, you are dealing in stolen goods. So I asked a lama, I said, if someone offers me a radio and I know it's been stolen, can I buy it? And they said, no. So I said, well, why? And they said, because that person who owned the radio, it was taken from them forcefully and now it's being offered to you for sale. So I said, well, what about meat, which has been forcefully taken from its owner without their consent, I assume, and being offered to me for sale? So this is not in the scriptures, this is Michael Roach's idea, okay? And I'm always honest to you that, you know, in the courses you don't see anything which is Michael Roach's idea. You know you're getting original readings. We put in all that Tibetan. Someday somebody will notice it's not the same, but that's another thing. No, just kidding. I'm still waiting to see if anyone reads it. But really only original scripture. That's my idea about meat, okay? But it would be exciting. You know, we started to get infected by their enthusiasm, which we didn't have when we went to them. And they're saying, you know, if American people got this idea, and you saved some cows, and you took good care of them until they died a natural death, you know, one cow is killed every minute in the United States. And then we went to the slaughterhouse, We sent Ian and somebody else to the slaughterhouse to try to film the local slaughterhouse in which these animals would be killed. And they took a lot of gross footage of the meat hanging up, the cows hanging up, and then the guy said, come back tomorrow because today we're killing pigs and tomorrow we're killing cows and we'll show you. And so, you know, there's this crisis the next morning. Nobody wanted to go, you know. And so Ian goes off with his camera, you know, and we're like kind of nervous waiting. We sent Elizabeth with him, and Rob figured out a way to do another errand and not go. And and then they came back and said the guy refused to let us in because he said his lawyer advised him that it would not be smart to let us film the thing. But the whole fact that people are hiding it and that you can't film it, and you know, and that it's something you and I have never seen. You know, I've never seen them do that. I've heard what they do, but I've never had the courage to go to one of those places. And Ian was messed up the whole day. He was still upset like 2 days later just seeing the carcasses hanging up from these hooks and the blood all over the floor and everything else. So I think it'd be an interesting project, I think, to get excited about that. We do have a concept in Buddhism called setar. Se means life, tar means to free life. And it means buy or somehow get possession of animals that are about to be killed and then release them and free them. And I think I was sitting in a restaurant in Ireland. There was an aquarium next to me. There were all these lobsters with their things taped. They couldn't like move. They were all piled on top of each other. And suddenly, for a split second, you know, I'm not like a big yogi, but my mind went into their mind for a second. And I was thinking how it felt to know you have this instinct that you're going to die and you're in this wrong place and somehow you can't move like you used to move, and the primal fear of that being piled there in this thing and moving against each other and knowing that you're going to die by being boiled, you know. Just for a second it came in my mind, And then we asked the waitress, you know, can we buy one of them? Because it was on the ocean side and we thought we'd let it go, you know. And they said, no, no, we have to ask the owner, you know. So I said, please ask the owner, because I got this, I obsessed with at least getting one out. It's like $18, but okay. And they wouldn't sell us one. They wouldn't let us take one. So not like this, maybe I should steal one, you know. And I didn't have the courage, you know. But anyway, that's part of what we'd like to do in Arizona. We will be getting with the property, I don't know, 250 head of cattle, and we'd like to keep them alive and take care of them. And just out of the sense of what it's like to be killed, they know they're going to be killed. When I went to India the very first time, I was 20 years old, I'm in an ashram near the Ganges River, and I had this intense dream about watching a cow die, and it knew it was going to die, and it had a human voice, which made things terrible. It was screaming, and they were cutting its throat, and it was screaming, and I remember it still vividly. And so I think that's a neat project. I think people, we should try to liberate life and free life whenever we can, and respect life of all kinds. And I think that'll be a nice thing to do. Secondly, part of the Arizona will be our retirement community, and the idea that in this country, and I grew up this way, you know, my parents, my stepmother still tells me, I'm independent. You don't have to take care of me. I don't expect you to take care of me. I'm going to keep my house. I said, come to Arizona. She said, no, I'm independent. I have my own house. I'll take care of myself. And there's this thing in America that your parents get to a certain age and they have to fend for themselves. Or you put them in a nursing home. And I used to be the nursing home liaison for Howell, New Jersey. Dozens of comic old people would come to me. I would put them in nursing homes for their children. And then it would be this gradual, lonely process of dying. This one was a resort hotel in the 1920s. It had a spiral staircase that goes up like five stories. And so people screaming on the bottom floor, you can hear them. It goes through every story all night, all day. And when you walked in, there'd be this gauntlet of old people in chairs reaching out to just to touch you, you know, just to touch a person that wasn't dying at the moment, you know. And the stink in every nursing home of urine and the way that the underpaid staff really treats them when no one's around, you know what I mean? So I think there's a great man in Australia named Salim Lee. We've been watching his idea of building like nursing homes and retirement communities that are Buddhist, and where you go and your death is like, you get trained how to do a nice death meditation, and you practice, and you spend your time learning meditations that you can do as you get old, and studying some scripture, learning how to chant things. You know, the idea, the ancient Indian idea of when you finally get liberated from your job at 62 or whatever, that you kind of cruise into death in a planned, compassionate way, you know, and that would be a good way for us to spend our energy, you know. Like, my vision of the place there is that we're studying intensely, we're meditating intensely, you know, we have intense rituals going on, and all kinds of tantric studies there. And I think it'd be a very beautiful part of that to have a community where we're taking care of old people. By about the time we get it ready, it'll be us, okay? And I'm not kidding, you know, it'll take, what, 10, 15 years to get it going well. And then we'll have a place to go. And I think the idea of my generation, the baby boomers, who were spiritually minded and didn't save a dime, okay? And the Social Security is used up, okay? It's already spent. The stuff I paid in is spent. And I think there's going to be this big crunch. And to have, like, our idea is to have very cheap, like maybe $150, $200 a month housing there, where you have your own beautiful little place. You're not like in one big huge building, but they're spread out all over the place, and you have your own like adobe meditation house, and you have maybe two comfortable rooms and a nice shower and a nice bathroom or something like that, and you can live on the cheap, and then you can go up to the temple and study meditation or whatever Tai Chi you can still do, and seriously, or yoga or something to keep yourself a little strong, and then people there who will take care of you as part of their practice, as an important part of their practice. And then you can study how to die properly and live quietly until you die. And I think they'd be a beautiful thing for American Buddhists to start from now, a custom of taking care of animals and old people that can't take care of themselves. Okay, so that's a, and we'll be in one of those categories. Okay, unless we practice right. So I'd like to put that, in Tibetan they say Semla Jakshu, which means keep it in your heart as an idea for the future. You know, that's something we could start spending some effort on. Especially I'd like the retirement community idea, something where you could spend your latter years in a meaningful way. And I see a lot of those people teaching at the university whatever skill they used to know. You know, all my great lamas have been over the age of 55 or 60, you know. And I think you'll find that the people who come to stay there in a retirement community would also have some incredible talents to give to a place like that, and to give, you know, and that's happened in our own organization. Dr. Taylor retired in 1986, and I stole him. And he's been running the Input Project since then, you know, and he's still running it, and there's incredible energy. He's like almost, I don't know how old he looks to you, but he's about 75, I think, or something. He's extraordinary. And he's still running everything. So, you know, I think those people, we should embrace them and make a relationship which is good for both. So I think about those two things. Okay, that American Buddhism should take care of older people in a way that helps them go right, in a nice, healthy, spiritual way. And then secondly, that, you know, if we played our cards right, the Jain guy yesterday told me, if you play your cards right, you know, the idea of killing these animals could be a thing of the past, eventually. You know, that if normal Americans get up and say, I haven't eaten meat for 20 years, and I feel fine. You know, the rancher from whom we're buying the property was just advised by his physician not to eat meat anymore. And he likes the idea. You know, he's gotten used to it now. And he says, I don't know why I used to eat 18-ounce steaks. You know, they killed me. They made me weak. They made me sick. But that's how I grew up. I didn't know any better. So I think it's something we can pull off, maybe. Okay? Semla Jakshu. We'll do a mandala. Okay? Pudola. Thank you.